You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. On the eve of the second anniversary of the terrorist attacks, we turn now to Peace Watch correspondent Fidel Rodriguez at Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles. He produced this segment on the one-year anniversary of the incident, but many of the thoughts of the people he spoke with seem just as relevant today.
1 week prior to the anniversary of September 11th, KPFK Pacifica went out to the streets of Southern California to get people's opinions regarding the September 11th attacks. We asked questions such as, how did September 11th affect your life? Who do you think was responsible for the September 11th attacks? 1 year after September 11th, how do you feel about the state of the nation? What is your definition of terrorism? Do you feel any indifferences towards Arab Americans since September 11th? What is most important to you in your community? Does the mass amount of surveillance cameras in our country make you feel safer? And do you have hope for the future? Here's what the people had to say.
Basically, it's brought in a lot of terror into my mind. Things that you took for granted, things that you, living in the United States, you really kind of felt pretty safe except for all the violence, you know, you don't really feel safe in the United States, but you didn't feel like you would be attacked from another country. And since this happened, it really kind of shattered, you know, all those old beliefs and really does bring a lot of terror into my everyday life.
I guess it changed my entire worldview in the sense that it really made me see my neighbors and my community and my country for what it really is. It was almost like it was a catalyst to like turn the light on everybody, from the patriotism to the courage that a lot of people showed on the left and activists and things like that. So personally, it was very jarring, and I still wake up in the morning and feel very jarred and like wonder what I'm gonna see that day. You know, I feel like I'm still trying to get my sea legs on this whole thing, and that's real. I guess professionally it's like, well, I'm in the business of providing information, literature and whatnot. So professionally it's made me like have to step up my game and really try to step up to my role as somebody who does that in my community. And a lot of people just aren't ready. And when I say they're not ready, I mean I think it takes a certain amount of courageousness to look in the mirror and say, what have I done to contribute to this? Or what can I do for my neighbors to take a look at what they're doing and try to build a community of resistance?
Actually, I'm one of the people that had changed my life. The reason why is because I'm an Indian person, and I had a pretty full beard at the time when it happened, and I was living in New York City. So I was an eyewitness to the collapse of the towers. And then the period after that, in which a lot of people kind of threw a blind rage from bigotry, really, that was encouraged by the president. They looked upon me as the enemy in the subways. I was threatened. And I was trying to create a discourse to say, hey, wait a minute, you know, the president's inventing something that isn't really about what this is all about. So it really affected me quite deeply. At a professional level, I'm an artist, and so I wanted to engage with communication about it, and almost all of my communication is about peace, not about war or about engendering war as a result of this action. So again, my work also became affected by it.
More of my time was spent paying attention to international politics, I guess, or affairs, states of affairs. Personally, it had it was sort of a claustrophobic environment developing around me, or atmosphere. So a loss of personal freedoms, I think, is what comes to mind.
I think it's not just the actual terrorists that did it. You know, I think the United States is, I think we're both responsible. I think that the whole issue of why this happened really has not really been brought to everybody's conscience, including mine. There's probably more that I could do to really find out about the issues. But I know in listening to President Bush and talk about how we have to get them and stop this terrorist, I think he's a terrorist himself, because I don't think violence is the answer. And it's really frightening from both ends.
I would say arrogance is responsible for this. We as Americans have to realize that there's a whole world out there. We use more natural resources than anybody else in the world, and we're making power moves to get more of those natural resources. And every time we go to the gas station and fill up our tank with gas, we have to recognize that that act alone is contributing to this. So, you know, whether or not CIA or George Bush or anybody else had something to do with crashing those airplanes, it's besides the point. Those people are the power brokers for a system that we all contribute to, a lifestyle that we all want to live to a certain extent. So I think we really have to look at ourselves, and there is a lot to be said about speaking truth to power and holding power accountable. But I think before we go there, we have to inform our communities as well, because there is going to be have to be a lot of consciousness raising before we get to that point, I feel.
I think the state of the nation is one that will never be the same. And I think we're in the, you know, the onset of maybe something even more frightening coming up, a war that who knows what it's going to implicate. And I think as a nation, we really haven't dealt with it, the causes of why this happened. I think we want to believe that we're so united and we're going to come back and we're going to rebound and we're not going to let anybody tell us basically what to do. And I think we were so caught up in that we really haven't had time really to go in deeper and really think about why this incident happened.
Just look at history and compare this to where we've been at. And I feel like we're probably in one of the biggest crises that we've ever known as a people. From what our children might have to go through, and if the powers that be go through with this, what they say is a war that's going to last a very, very long time, probably the rest of our lifetimes. And like I said, once you have a broader view and realize there's a world out there, you got to think, if I'm going to have a conscience, us equals them, you know? They say you're either for us or against us. So in light of everything this country has been through and all of the dissent that has been systematically targeted throughout our history, I think we really have to recognize that right now we, as people of conscience, need to unify. So I think we need to recognize this as a crisis, and we need to act accordingly.
I think overall, maybe there's a sense of, there's like this desperate, increasing isolation that one kind of feels like America closing on itself. I think that in reality, what has happened is kind of the opposite, that America is now maybe more connected to the rest of the world, you know. Meaning by that people realize that what happens over there affects them here, and what they do over there affects them here. So though politically the state we're in is one of like extreme control by a small group of people, you know, it seems like the military and the oil interests really have a stronghold on foreign policy. I don't think they do necessarily on the will of the nation, you know, and maybe the debate is increasing. I mean, this is hopeful that the debate is increasing as to, you know, what is going on in the world.
Well, terror is, I think, a kind of the extreme of fear. That's what I think terror is. And terrorism is to evoke fear. And this can be done either through violence or through just language. And I, you know, the other day I heard Barack on your show say, Bush is the biggest terrorist. And many people probably get unnerved by that. But I think that's kind of true, you know. We have a habit of engendering fear in tons of people because of our behavior, Americans, I mean. And somehow we don't call that terrorism, you know. Terrorism is when you take your power and you make somebody else afraid. That's what I think terrorism is. And there's real active terrorism, like in Palestine and like what happened on September 11th. But there's lots of different kinds. I don't know how much more I'd say about that, you know.
The term in today's context is just being thrown around like there ain't no tomorrow. And I think we have to recognize that there's terror on so many different levels. The police in this community commit terror all the time. That's why people are afraid to step outside of their little box. You know, every time that somebody in the world wants to become an independent nation and stand up for themselves, and if it doesn't go along with the neoliberal program, then we implement terrorism. Our government, our armies, our troops. So I think we have to really look at that and not just be so reactionary when we use it. Well, this is a terrorist because this person decided to stand up for himself, or this group of people decided to do something about a problem that exists in their communities, you know. So I think it's a shame that we've gotten to this point where a word can be so powerful and be so controlled by the media that most people don't even really want to look at terrorism for what it is, or don't even really know what it is. They just know that it's something that they need to be scared of at whatever cost and give up whatever they have to give up to be protected. And I just think that's sad.
By ethnicity itself, we've been, shot at, discriminated against, and I mean, because of that, I think maybe that gives me a different outlook at people and how to accept them and respect them for who they are and what they are.
The one thing that the Muslims, I think, and the Arabs knew right after this happened is that they knew what everybody else feared. They were aware of the thing that we're all fearing, and it's because they were the subject. They were the subject of this people staring and the rudeness and they're the most recent engine, you know. And I feel tremendous compassion, and I myself was born a Hindu, so they try to make war between us and the Muslims all the time, and I believe humanity is one, you know. I mean, it's not even about what God you name, or it's about helping each other out, you know.
The spectrum of people that being an American we are in the process of seeing that narrowed, or there's people who would like to have the breadth of being American means be largely reduced. I like to think of at least two Americas, you know, Martin Luther King's America and the America that killed him, you know, Malcolm X's America and the America that killed him, you know, Rosa Parks' America and the America that told her the law was that she in fact had to go to the back of the bus. I don't know what being an American is. I hope it's something closer to Jimi Hendrix and George Bush, you know.
The Voices of Southern California, produced by Fidel Rodriguez and others at Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles. It was produced on the one-year anniversary of the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001.
Survival. Children,
my brother,
in this crisis,
we're in a crisis.
We've got to hold on.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The way it should be, right? To survive, you gotta have self-determination and a whole lot of faith. In this world, you need friends, family, people you can depend on. In the crisis, we gotta survive.
Yeah.
Survive.
Sister, you can't.
fingers set. Help the children, for they're the future. Invest in the best.
Crisis by Sounds of Blackness. Finally, tonight, as we commemorate the second anniversary of the terrorist attacks, we hear part two of a talk by award-winning investigative journalist William Thomas, who says that the attacks of September 11th prompted a series of questions that have yet to be answered.
Investigation? There has been no investigation, almost 3 years later. For every airline crash, there's an intense investigation. We saw the space shuttle Columbia explode. They're still investigating. They're coming up with some answers. But while that crash has been extensively and continues to be extensively investigated, nothing is happening in terms of answers surrounding September 11th, and we have to wonder, what is the government trying to hide? Immediately after those attacks, we were told who the aggressor was. It was Iraq. Iraq. Well, not really. It was Osama bin Laden. Oh, that guy on the kidney dialysis machine in the cave in Afghanistan, afraid to use his cell phone, his satellite phone, because he'd get a missile through the receiver. It was him. But wait a minute, wasn't he the guy trained and paid by the United States government in Afghanistan to fight the Soviets in what the Americans later called a bear trap? Son of one of the wealthiest families in a country dripping with wealth, except, of course, for the poverty of the dispossessed. The bin Laden family, major players in the Carlyle Group. But you know, that's curious. The bin Laden family, now let's see, they founded Bioport. Bioport owns and controls the only anthrax vaccine in America. Gee, that's interesting. And Bioport, it turns out, was working with the Ames strain of anthrax used in the attacks on America. Bioport was working with a company called Battelle Corporation, which is the world leader, if not the discoverer, of how to put an electrostatic charge on something like anthrax so that when you open the envelope, it's not just you that gets a dose, but it floats around the room, contaminates the entire room, and guess what? You can shut down the entire U.S. Senate and ram through Patriot One without any congressperson reading that bill. A bill, by the way, that reads word for word, identical to the laws and proclamations passed by someone named Adolf Hitler. The only exception is Hitler outlawed freedom of assembly. We're not quite there yet. And it was Battelle who hired William Patrick, foremost expert on biowarfare, to write a paper on how to distribute anthrax through the mail. But we didn't hear about this because when the FBI went to investigate Bioport and Battelle, they were told to lay off. It's off limits. So 15 of the 19 hijackers had Saudi Arabian passports. That's very interesting, you know, because 7 of those 19 alleged hijackers are still alive and very upset to have their names and photographs spread all over the world. Legitimate folks, pilots, oil engineers, nothing to do with terrorism. And another one, an 8th, had died a year before. So there's something very wrong with this list of 19 hijackers. And what about the 3 other airplanes? The 2 diverted to Canada with identical box cutters on board. What happened to the people, the terrorists on those planes? We haven't heard. And a 3rd plane that was stalled by the grounding order on a New York runway, and a group of young Arab gentlemen jumped up and started yelling and shouting that they demanded the flight take off to Los Angeles. They made quite a scene, but somehow, you know, they managed to escape from the airplane over the jetway before the police arrived. And we haven't heard anything more about those folks either. But anyway, the U.S. said we have to go to Afghanistan and kill a lot of people because that's where Osama bin Laden lives. Of course, he got away, and after a while, oh, it really isn't Osama bin Laden anyway. Actually, we want to liberate the people of Afghanistan from the terrible Taliban, who did such terrible things to women in particular, which is very true. The question is, what in the world was the U.S. government doing, putting the Taliban in power, supporting them, and giving them hundreds of millions of dollars over the year while they did these terrible things to women and to the people of Afghanistan? That's the question here. Again and again, we see this country to the south going after monsters of its own making and calling that liberation. I call it hypocrisy, and it's the kind of cynicism that destroys democracy and hope. Of course, the big deal in Afghanistan, we have to get that pipeline going, get the oil flowing. Slight glitch, I'm here tonight to report the latest studies from the oil industry says, oh, sorry about that, this big ocean of oil around the Caspian Sea, we have to downgrade that 4/5. There's 1/5 of the oil there that, that the U.S. government thought it was getting. 1/5 of the control available to the countries addicted to that oil. So they're going to have to look somewhere else. Maybe to that country that has the second biggest oil field, series of oil fields on the planet, as Bush says, Iraq, the oldest civilization on Earth, the founding civilization. And now we see the cowboys trying to deal with a culture 7,000 years old. It's tragic, but fascinating. And all of a sudden, last year, since I spoke last, Saddam has become the biggest threat to the world. And I wondered, why all of a sudden? Why after 10 years? Why after the inspectors went through that country and destroyed, yes, considerable stockpiles of chemical and biological weapons supplied and sold to Saddam by the United States government? But wait a minute, isn't Saddam one of your guys too? It turns out that he is. It turns out, according to Mr. Sales of the UPI, who just broke a big story about 2 weeks ago, that Saddam Hussein was funded by the CIA to join a six-man hit squad to take out the leader of Iraq in 1956, Mr. Qasim. That was Keystone Cops all the way. They didn't get Mr. Qasim, but one of his own men shot Saddam, just a graze, or we'd have a very different history as well. But in 59, Saddam and his team succeeded. You see, Mr. Qasim, it turns out, was also a brutal tyrant, thug. But that was cool, you see, because he'd signed an anti-communist pact. And when he changed his mind and said, no, I don't think I'll go there, they decided, whoops, he has to go. And in 59, he was eliminated. The CIA distributed weapons to the Ba'athist Party, and they end up killing hundreds, if not thousands, of alleged communists. Saddam Hussein was a major part of those executions. And throughout the 80s, the CIA climbed into bed with the Ba'athists. The 80s were a very busy time, because in 88, Mr. Rumsfeld is shaking the hands of that murderous dictator in Baghdad, trying to sell a pipeline deal for a very big company I ran into in the Middle East called Bechtel. They wanted to run a pipeline up to Aqaba in Jordan. And Saddam thought about this. Rumi made a second trip. He thought about this. And Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Perl, the gang, were very incensed when Saddam decided to sign the contracts with France, China, and Russia instead. And in 1991, the so-called Gulf War, which was really a slaughter, and I say that personally because I walk the highway to hell, and that's an experience I recommend to everyone who thinks war is somehow a solution or a good idea. But in 91, there was a blockade against Iraq, a blockade that took medicine out of the hospitals, food out of people's mouths, and didn't even permit pencils to be brought into the country for children to have in school, but Halliburton got a $24 million contract to help repair those oil wells. In fact, more than 24 American corporations got lucrative contracts after 91, during the embargo, during the blockade. Sounds like treason to me, but it sounds like profits to them. So my friends, we begin to see the outline of something that is not really a conspiracy, but complicity. of corporate profit, of a military, corporate, entertainment complex to sell the weapons and to continue profiting from a permanent war economy. That's where we are tonight.
William Thomas is an award-winning investigative journalist and former reporter for the Environmental News Service. He spoke several months ago in Vancouver, Canada, at an event sponsored by the group Necessary Voices. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet. We had production assistance this evening from Mark Torres of the Pacifica Radio Archives, Matt Bradley, and Keith Chalgian. It's your financial support that makes Peace Watch possible, so we urge you to make a generous donation through our secure online website at pacifica.org. Or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.